Good evening. This is Valerie Jackson in Conversation, a program where I talk with some of today's most dynamic artists, innovative thinkers, and interesting personalities. Dr. Lewis W. Sullivan is the founding dean and first president of the Morehouse School of Medicine. He's a committed health advocate, educator, author, physician, and under President George H.W. Bush was secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. In this position, Dr. Sullivan managed the agency responsible for the health, welfare, food and drug safety, medical research, and so much more for the American people. Currently, Dr. Sullivan is the chair of the board of the National Health Museum in Atlanta. Its goal is to improve health literacy and to advocate healthy behavior. He's also chair of the Washington, D.C.-based Sullivan Alliance to Transform America's Health Professionals. He's the author of two books, The Morehouse Mystique, Becoming a Doctor at the Nation's Newest African-American Medical School with Mary Beth Gassman, and Breaking Ground, My Life in Medicine with David Chernoff. Thank you so much for joining me today, Dr. Sullivan.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Your first book, The Morehouse Mystique, Becoming a Doctor at the Nation's Newest African-American Medical School. Now, I know what the Morehouse Mystique is, having been married to a Morehouse man, but for those in the audience who may be unfamiliar with the history of Morehouse College, just what is this thing called the Morehouse Mystique?
Right. Well, the students, faculty, and alumni of Morehouse refer to the Morehouse Mystique as that environment, that essence of the institution that encourages you to work hard, to succeed, to try and be number one in whatever you do, to have a life of service, and have a character that is impeccable. So all of those things we feel contribute to the reality that Morehouse alumni generally do well, whether it's in business, law, medicine, or other fields. And the environment of the school encourages that. So it's a strong academic institution. But added to that is that environment that tells its students, we expect you to do well. We expect you to succeed. So that really is what we call the Morehouse Mystique. Everything accounts for that.
And what it does, too, is to give the men there a certain level of confidence. At least that's what I've seen. But there's this saying also, you can always tell a Morehouse man, you just can't tell him much. Because there is a thin line sometimes between confidence and arrogance.
Oh, yes.
But usually,
we've heard that many
usually
times.
They live up to it, though. They
yes.
usually live up to
right.
it. So how did you get to Morehouse? Because you grew up here in Atlanta and also in a rural area called...
Right, called Blakely.
Blakely, right.
Because I was born here at Grady Hospital in Atlanta, but by the time I was age two, my father had moved the family first to Albany and then to Blakely. Because when I was born, he was a life insurance salesman for Atlanta Life Insurance Company. But that was during the Depression. Nobody was buying life insurance. So he decided he needed to pursue another career. So he became an undertaker in Blakely, Georgia, the first black funeral home established in that small community in the southwestern part of our state. There he established a chapter of the NAACP, began annual Emancipation Day celebrations, and he worked to get blacks registered to vote. So he was really an interrupter in the culture then, because he was working very hard to improve the lives of blacks. And as part of that, they recognized that schools for blacks in rural Georgia during those years of segregation were really not very good. So when I was in the fifth grade, my brother in the sixth grade, they sent us first to Savannah for a year to live with relatives to attend school there, and the next year sent us back to Atlanta to attend schools here. So I finished Booker Washington High School here in Atlanta, which was the only high school for blacks in Atlanta at that time. So I had a great experience at Booker Washington High. So when I finished Booker Washington High in 1950, that was the environment that we had. My classmates, many of them, were going to Morehouse College. My mother had gone to Clark, and my older brother had gone to Clark, so I was expected to go to Clark. But because of the reputation of Morehouse College and the fact that my friends were going there, I wanted to go to Morehouse also. So that's how I ended up at Morehouse College.
Yet you wanted to be a physician. I've heard when you were 5 years old, you decided that you wanted to be a doctor. That didn't necessarily mean Morehouse, though, especially since at that time they certainly yes. didn't have a medical school.
No, that's correct. What happened was my father, being an undertaker, also provided ambulance services for people who were ill, who had to go to or from the hospital. And there was one black doctor in Southwest Georgia at that time, Dr. Joseph Griffin in Bainbridge, 1 mile south of Blakely. He was our family doctor because my parents really rejected the indignity of having to go into a separate waiting room or around the back to go to a white doctor in Blakely. They only went there when there was an emergency. They had no other choice. So in going to Bainbridge, my father would often ask me to go with him to help. Well, of course, I was quite small, and I now recognize my father was really exposing me to Dr. Griffin. He was successful. He was always wearing green scrub suits. You'd open the door to his clinic that he had built, 25-bed clinic. There'd be the smell of ether. And he was someone we knew who could do magical things. He could make sick people well. I was impressed by all of that. So I wanted to be like Dr. Griffin. So when I was age 5 and my mother asked me and my brother what we wanted to do, my brother was going to be an undertaker. He was going to follow in my father's footsteps. But that's when I said I wanted to be a doctor.
And did you live up to those words? You graduated from Morehouse with honors and then went on to Boston University School of Medicine. A brief review of that experience. Did you find it difficult?
Well, first of all, I would say that back in those years, in the early 50s, there were two black medical schools, and most of the black physicians being trained in the United States then attended those two schools, Howard in Washington, D.C., which opened in 1868, and Meharry in Nashville, which opened in 1881. So at the time that I graduated from Morehouse in 1954, my teachers at Morehouse, along with career counseling people who came to Morehouse from places like the Urban League, NAACP, encouraged us to look further, to certainly attend those two schools, but to look at other schools as well. So I applied to Boston University, University of Michigan, and other schools in addition to Howard and Meharry. And Boston University accepted me first.
Were you one of the first blacks to be accepted into the medical school?
I was the only black in my class of 76 mm-hmm. students at mm-hmm. Boston University. But Boston University had a history going back to the late 1890s of accepting black students, including a black woman, Rebecca Lee. The school had this reputation. So when I entered Boston University School of Medicine in 1954, although I was the only black in my class, there were two others in the school. Mm-hmm. Now, that may sound like very few, but in those years, it was unusual for white medical schools to have black students.
Any at all.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I had a great experience at Boston University. I was well accepted by my classmates and also by the faculty. But when I entered, being the first Morehouse alumnus to attend Boston University School of Medicine, and the fact that most of my classmates had never heard of Morehouse, I had some questions. How am I going to do in this new environment? Am I going to really measure up? Am I going to represent my parents well? Am I going to be a good alumnus of the college? So there was that tension. But we had our first examination 3 weeks later, and I got an A.
Then
I realized.
So you knew you could hang, huh?
Exactly. So I ended up doing well at Boston University and finished third in my class.
Was that? Great. You had an early interest, or developed, I believe, an early interest in hematology at Boston. Is that correct?
Oh, yes. While I was a medical student, I loved doing microscopic work, looking at cells under the microscope. And so hematology, blood diseases, at that time involved a lot of microscopy, examining blood smears to help make a diagnosis of anemia or leukemia or other conditions like that. So that appealed to me, as well as treating patients who had blood diseases. So by the time I graduated, I felt that this might be an area I would want mm-hmm. to pursue. So I then went on to Cornell Medical Center, New York Hospital, where again, there was the first black intern they had ever taken. I wondered how I would do well. Plus, I was the first Boston University graduate who had attended Cornell Medical Center. But again, I had a great experience. And of interest, the chairman of medicine in my department was a man named Hugh Lucky. He was from Tennessee and had one of the thickest Southern drawls I ever heard. So when I went in to be interviewed by him, and I had not known him, I wondered then if I was going to be selected, but I was. And it turned out that he was very supportive of me in every way. He called me in. I'd been there 2 weeks after starting as an intern there in 1958, asked questions, but he told me that he wanted to be sure that I had a great experience there at Cornell, because everyone knew I was the first black intern, and he was determined that I would have a good experience. And I did.
Good.
And
we
became great friends.
And you eventually became chief of hematology at Boston University. Is that correct?
Oh, yes. Yes. After I had my work at Cornell, I went back to Boston for my training in hematology and ended up on the faculty at Boston University and became the director of the hematology service for Boston University at Boston City Hospital.
And once again, being the first full-time African-American faculty member.
Yes.
But then you got a call from Hugh Gloster, who was the longtime president of Morehouse College, and he made you an offer you couldn't refuse in 1975. Tell us about Morehouse School of Medicine.
Well, that really was a fascinating period for me, and actually for medical education in the country in general. What was happening in the 50s and 60s and 70s were two major events that converged. First was the Civil Rights Movement, with all of the activities, with the student sit-ins, the voter registration drives, the work of Martin Luther King Jr., Rosa Parks, and others. And that opened the nation's eyes to the indignities suffered by the black community. But the other movement that was underway was the expansion of medical education, starting in the mid-50s with two new medical schools that opened, Albert Einstein in New York and Seton Hall Medical School in Jersey City, New Jersey. They were the first of 47 new schools that came into existence between 1956 and 1981. As part of that expansion, a committee was formed by the Georgia Department of Health to look at the physician needs in Georgia. That committee was co-chaired by Rhodes Haverty, a white physician who was dean of the School of Allied Health at Georgia State University. And the other co-chair was Dr. Louis Brown, a black physician, internist here in Atlanta. That committee found that Georgia ranked 38 among the 50 states in physician manpower. Georgia also was lower than the national average in the health of its citizens. So that committee recommended expansion of medical education in the state of Georgia, and also stated that any such expansion should help to address the shortage of black physicians in Georgia, because only 2% of the physicians in Georgia at that time were African American, although 28% of Georgia citizens were African American. So that was the basis for Morehouse College deciding to look at starting a medical school.
But that's a rough, tough thing to do, even for a well-established university. Medical schools just weren't that, well, I'm not sure what the word would be, easy.
Well, yes. Oh, yes.
So what was the determining factor for you that made you want to bite this bullet?
Right. Well, there's several things. First of all, when I had gone to Boston University School of Medicine, it was with the intention that I was coming back to Georgia to practice, and I was going to be like Dr. Griffin, a general physician taking care of people who needed services in Georgia. I had gotten diverted in medical school. I learned about all kinds of fields in medicine, including hematology, to which I had become very attracted, and had then pursued a career of hematology research and teaching, and became a faculty member at Boston University. So when the idea of a medical school at Morehouse came, there were many factors, including I consider this a chance to really help address the issue that took me to Boston University Medical School in the first place. More doctors here in Georgia, particularly for those who are not well served. The second thing was, this is my alma mater, looking at this question. And of course, being a Morehouse man, I was very committed to the institution, very dedicated. Thirdly, Morehouse College had always had a strong pre-medical program. For example, in my graduating class of 57 students in 1954, 19 of us were pre-med. 18 of us went off to medical school, not only to Howard and Meharry, and I went to Boston, another classmate to Case Western Reserve, another to the University of Wisconsin, another to the University of Arkansas, and they all had done well. So Hugh Gloucester, knowing the college's history of a strong pre-medical program, knowing the need, decided that this was something the college should look at. But it's after Atlanta University had looked at this and decided that this was not feasible, because ordinarily you would expect Atlanta University to do this.
Being the graduate school leg of the complex.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So when Atlanta University took a pass, that's when Hugh Gloucester said, well, Morehouse College would like to look at this. And so they formed a committee, two committees, one within the college, and then the second was an advisory committee of college alumni who were in academic medicine positions around the country. So I was invited to be a part of that committee. And we looked at that, and my perspective changed from initially being concerned that this may not be something the college could pull off, to really then being convinced that it could.
And should be.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. There was a need, no question about it.
Speaking of that word need, I'm sure one of the arguments that you got when you were trying to develop funds for the school was, why do we need a black medical school? I mean, there are great schools already out there, and blacks can go to Harvard now and to Cornell and to wherever they want to. So why do we need a black medical school?
Right.
What's your answer?
Well, the answer that I gave to that was this. While places like Harvard and Stanford did have black students, they were still rare. They were not sufficient. And secondly, that Morehouse College, like a number of other black colleges, had a strong academic environment and could indeed develop a strong medical school building on that environment and help address this need. Because my position has always been, you can be a strong academic institution whether you're white, black, Jewish, Mormon, right, Catholic, or what have you. You bring an added perspective to the educational experience there. People don't question, why do we need a Brandeis,
right,
with its Jewish heritage or a Brigham Young with its Mormon heritage? They provide strong educational experiences, but they also give a strong cultural experience for their students, and that helps inform our citizens around the country. The same for black institutions. That there is a heritage that we have that we're very proud of. We want to not only live up to that heritage, but really share it with others. So I felt that in the same perspective for black medical school, and that has indeed been the way things have turned out.
We're going to take a short station break, and we'll be back in conversation with Dr. Lewis Sullivan. This is Valerie Jackson, back in conversation with Dr. Lewis Sullivan, founding dean and first president of the Morehouse School of Medicine. He's also chairman of the board here at Public Broadcasting Atlanta. He's sharing with us the early days and development of the School of Medicine. It's interesting how you indicated in your book that you looked for a special type of student for these first students to graduate or to be in the class, the Morehouse School of Medicine. Risk takers. Why did you look for that type of student?
Well, we look for those students because, in addition to being academically qualified, we wanted students who indeed knew they were coming into a new institution. They were going to help develop the template for that institution. This wasn't really following something that had long been established. We wanted to have students who were comfortable in such a new environment, in establishing the traditions of the institution, who would be excited by that, not intimidated. So those were the students who came in those first few classes, and they really did a great job for the institution.
Well, the start was not without its bumps and rough spots, which you called lessons in leadership. So talk a little bit about maybe the toughest lesson that you learned.
The toughest lessons, of course, are really how to develop an institution so that it functions as an organism. we're all different. We all have different perspectives, different capacities, etc. And so how do you really bring people together in a new experience so that they first learn from each other, they learn how to work together, how to trust each other, how to have different perspectives, and how to really argue about a point, but still do it in a positive way so that when you come to a resolution, everyone buys in. That's what makes an institution strong. So that really was a challenge for us in developing the Morehouse School of Medicine, because we were recruiting faculty from all over the country, even from Thailand, Americans who had gone there to work in a medical school in Mahidol University there in Thailand. So that was really a great challenge, but also very satisfying to do that. So that was something we learned over time. And that's when Hugh Gloucester also was very helpful to me. Because while I was professor of medicine at Boston University, when I was recruited back to Morehouse, I really had not been a senior administrator, learning how to develop a budget, a spreadsheet. How do you really set priorities in your institution, too? How do you really build those teams? So Gloucester had really had that experience. And so we got along very well. He didn't know much about medical education, but he knew a lot about administration, so we worked very well together as a team.
Yes, he was a great president, great president. One of the Morehouse School of Medicine's most prominent board members was Barbara Bush, former First Lady Barbara Bush, who came aboard in 1983. How did you get to know her and to convince her to join the board?
Well, that, like so many instances, that was an interesting story in itself, because I often say that developing this medical school was really a combination of being ready at the right time and being prepared, and serendipity. So Barbara Bush coming on the board was a combination of both. Our first building for the medical school we constructed, and we occupied that building in the late summer of 1982. Now, we started instruction at the school in September of 1978 when our first class came in. So we were operating in facilities scattered around Morehouse College's campus. But our first building was dedicated in July of 82, and our speaker for that was then Vice President George H.W. Bush. So he came, he had a great reception. We had people like Andy Young and Ed McIntyre, Mayor of Augusta, John Lewis, many of the white and black politicians who were here, and they were all really having a great time getting their pictures taken, and et cetera. So 2 weeks later, Vice President Bush called me, said he was planning a trip to Sub-Saharan Africa for 2 weeks, visiting eight countries, and he would like for me to be part of his delegation. So I then asked, well, gosh, Mr. Vice President, I'm honored by this, but I'm not in the government, so what would my role be? And he said, well, Lou, to be honest with you, this is the first trip of a senior member of the Reagan administration to Sub-Saharan Africa, and we don't have an Andy Young in our administration, because remember, Andy Young was very prominent in the Carter administration, ambassador to the UN, et cetera. So he said, you know, you would do me a favor, but more importantly, you'd do the country a service if you'd be willing to go. You'd help our delegation, and we would have an itinerary set up for you. So I appreciated his honesty, and I accepted. On that trip was Barbara Bush. While the vice president was meeting with heads of state, she was meeting with women's groups, usually adult literacy groups, and I learned about her interest in literacy. So after the 2 weeks were over and we were heading back to the States on the plane, I told Barbara, I said, you know, you're in the same business, in education. I'm in medical education. You're in adult literacy education. We need to work together. You need to be on our board. So she said, well, Lou, I don't know, but let me check this out, and if I can do it, I will. So she called a few days later. She checked with the White House counsel. She said she could do it.
Wow.
So she came on our board in 1983, and she was a serious trustee. She missed one meeting in 6 years as a member of the Board of Trustees for the medical school.
That's outstanding. Well, then you got a call from President George Bush, whom you could not refuse. Now, you've invested in the Morehouse School of Medicine all these years, and then President Bush makes you an offer to join his administration. First of all, were you surprised?
Yes, I was surprised because I was lobbying him very heavily to appoint one of my trustees to be Secretary of Health and Human Services if he won the election, because I had a different plan. My plan was with Bush in the White House and my trustee being Secretary of Health and Human Services, I'd have access both to the department and to the White House. But when I called to congratulate him after the election the next morning, I said, now remember, you and I had talked about Monroe, who would be a great secretary. And he said, well, Lou, I remember that, but you know, I need to talk with you about that. So if you'd be willing to come up to Washington in a couple of weeks after things have settled down, we need to talk. So I was surprised. I hung up and I said, what did he mean by that? I said, maybe I'm kidding myself. It sounds like he wants to talk to me. And sure enough, that's the way it happened.
Well, you were widely acknowledged as one of the most effective and influential secretaries in the department's history. So you were obviously doing many things right. In fact, your tenure was responsible for several things. One, creating new nutrition labels and warnings, which was a real struggle, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. One of the longest meetings I had in the Oval Office was a debate between me and Ed Madigan, who was our Secretary of Agriculture. We wanted to have a new food label so that our citizens could understand what the label meant. What percentage of a daily requirement did the amount of sodium or vitamins, et cetera, mean? Madigan was concerned because the cattle and dairy industries were concerned that this label might show indeed the amount of fat in some of the foods and therefore could be damaging to them. But so we had our debates, and then the president decided in our favor. So then we were able to proceed with the new food label. So that was one major thing that we were able to accomplish. But the other thing in the department that I wanted to do, that I talked with President-elect Bush about when he invited me to Washington, was getting more diversity into the department. And he said, I support you. I think we need that. And so I would support you in every way. So during my tenure, first of all, we were able to appoint a number of women to positions for the first time. The first female director of the National Institutes of Health, Dr. Bernadine Healy, the first black woman to be Social Security Commissioner, Gwendolyn King, the first female and first Hispanic Surgeon General, Tony Novello. We also established a women's health unit, and Dr. Vivian Penn, female physician, one of the early black graduates of the University of Virginia School of Medicine. She became the director of our women's health research unit. And a number of other people, Bill Tobey, African-American, became director of Healthcare Financing Administration, currently now CMS, with Medicare and Medicaid. So I worked to have more diversity in the department so that the problems affecting all segments of our population would be recognized and would be addressed.
Now, Dr. Sullivan, you're a Republican. Quiet as it's kept.
Well.
But you're one of the few Republicans who has voiced public support of Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act. Why? Why do you support
well,
it?
Well, I do that for this reason. First of all, it's needed. I think it is really a national disgrace that we have 47 million Americans without health insurance. Those people are without insurance and the others who are underinsured. That means that their access to care is impaired. We have the best science, the strongest research, the best trained health professionals, but that goes for naught if you cannot have access to them. I believe that while each of us has a responsibility for preserving and protecting and maintaining our own health, we also have a community responsibility to each other to really assist each other when indeed things are going rough. But there's a practical aspect to this as well. People who are not healthy really need more social services. They cost more in our system. Healthy people are able to work, earn wages, take care of their families, pay taxes to support common activities such as roads, education, and so forth. So from a practical standpoint, we should be doing everything we can to see that our citizens remain healthy. So Indeed.
If nothing else, but to keep the bottom line down, to keep the costs down.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So I say that while being conservative on a number of things, including fiscal conservatism, you really need to have a purpose for your decisions. Purpose for health is to really improve people's health, because if we don't fund our health system, it doesn't mean that we don't pay for that. We do pay for it in ways that we don't, we're not aware. It means that the unfunded budget for public hospitals like Grady is higher. Those funds have to come from somewhere. And it means our citizens are not as healthy as they should. In fact, we as a country are not number one in terms of the health status of our citizens, although we're number one in terms of the expenditures in our system. That means we're not spending our dollars wisely. So I believe that having a health system that provides access to all of our citizens is the wisest position.
So what do you think the Affordable Care Act needs to focus on now? The president announced recently that he's extending for 2 more years some of the insurance policies to avoid insurance companies canceling those policies because they had not met the criteria. What do you think about that, and what do you think we really need to focus on with respect to the Affordable Care Act?
Right. Well, first of all, the strategies to see that everyone has a form of insurance is important. That's already happened in a number of cases. Young people who can stay on their parents' plans to age, I think, 26. Development of the health exchanges so that people can have access to insurance that's affordable. Subsidies for people who cannot afford them. All of that is up and running. There are technical problems, to be sure. But there are always technical problems. Anyone who has bought a computer may know that it may take some time before that is working. I do think that the president and his staff made a mistake by really giving the impression that everything was going to be smooth, because that was not the case. And when Medicare and Medicaid were introduced back in the mid-60s, there were 2 or 3 years to get things working smoothly there.
Right.
So the fact is, it was off to a rough start, but it's improving. So the fact that there were some problems does not justify abandoning the program. Having access to health care is too important for all of our citizens and for the country in general. So we need to work to improve the problems with the system. No one is saying it's perfect. It's impossible to develop on one shot a system that's going to work perfectly. So we need to focus on improving it.
We'll be back after a break and continue talking with Dr. Lewis Sullivan. Welcome back. I'm Valerie Jackson. Tonight, we're in conversation with the former Secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Dr. Lewis Sullivan. He's also chairman of the board here at Public Broadcasting Atlanta. We'll continue my conversation with Dr. Sullivan and discuss his new book, Breaking Ground, My Life in Medicine. In Breaking Ground, sir, you accomplished several things that did break a ceiling or a ground. We mentioned earlier how you were the first African-American at Boston Medical School, first African-American at New York Hospital, Cornell, full-time African-American faculty at Boston University, and so forth and so on. But you also helped others to break barriers, people that you appointed when you were Secretary of Health and Human Services, the first female director you mentioned earlier, the first Hispanic female Surgeon General, the first African-American Commissioner of Social Security. By the way, they took Social Security out of the Department of Health and Human Services back in 1994.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Again, was a decision that I would not have made. That was based in part on advocacy groups who were supporting President Clinton. He promised that he would do that if he were elected. So that's what happened. The reason I would not have done it was because the computer systems with all of the information for our citizens, for Medicare and Medicaid, are the same systems for Social Security. So really, taking that out is really a very complicated and costly process here.
You had worked very hard to develop the electronic transfer of information, didn't you?
Yes, we established a committee in 1991 to look at ways to develop electronic health medical records. And that formed the basis for the HIPAA legislation that was passed in 1996. And of course, now our health system is rapidly becoming a completely electronic system. Mm-hmm. So yes, we were involved in the early stages of that.
Good. Before we got sidetracked on the Social Security issue, we were talking about some of the people that you had helped to break barriers. I mentioned a few who are outstanding, but then there was also one who I think you may have had second thoughts about helping, and that was Clarence Thomas. Hmm. Talk about that experience and what happened with him.
For me, that really was, in retrospect, a very painful experience because he was nominated by President Bush. I had not known him, had not heard of him before, but there was resistance to his nomination.
To the Supreme Court.
Yeah, to the Supreme Court from a number of organizations. Primarily this is someone we don't know. Where has he come from? Why there are a number of qualified African Americans who really could serve well on the Supreme Court. So that was it. So when this happened, President Bush asked me and Connie Newman, African American woman who is head of the Office of Personnel Management, to come to Kennebunkport. We went up to talk with him about this. And he, having nominated Clarence Thomas, he's very committed and loyal to people that he nominates. So he said that he wanted to really try and do everything to get him confirmed, and would we help in that by meeting with a number of organizations like the NAACP and the Urban League and others to see if we could garner their support. So we agreed to do that, but neither one of us knew him. He said we need to meet him first and find out what he's like, what are his values, et cetera. So and the president agreed, and so we met with him in Washington. And he convinced us that the concerns of the African-American community, civil rights issues, voting rights, equal treatment, the fact that the civil rights activities had been dismantling segregation, because, you know, I went to Boston University Medical School in 1954 because legally I could not go to medical school in Georgia at that time. Mm. So I had experienced directly many of these same indignities that the black community in general was concerned about. So we met with Clarence, and he convinced us that while he was relatively unknown, that his perspective on these issues was the same as ours, and that he would be working to expand opportunities, et cetera. So based upon that, Connie and I went to various organizations like the NAACP, Urban League, et cetera, we're not very lucky in the response we got. John Jacobs, who was head of the Urban League I met with, John took this back to his group and called me a couple of days later and says, Lou, I'm sorry, we don't know this man, so we cannot give an endorsement. Connie went to the NAACP, same experience. I went out to Houston to the annual meeting of CORE with James Farmer, same thing. Met with Reverend Lowry, Joseph Lowry, then head of SCLC, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And Reverend Lowry said, well, gee, I don't know this man. I'd like to meet him and talk with him. So we arranged that. So Reverend Lowry came up with a couple of his colleagues, and we met in Connie Newman's townhouse up on Capitol Hill for about 2 hours. And Reverend Lowry, I remember, said something like this. He said, well, you know, I'm getting to be an old man now, and I want to be sure that when I go to my grave, that the man who's sitting in the seat held by Thurgood Marshall has same values. And Clarence said, well, Reverend Lowry, you can count on that. I'm from Pinpoint, Georgia, and I know what oppression is, and I'm going to work to really stop that, so you'll be proud of me. So Reverend Lowry said, well, okay, you've convinced me, and I'll see if I can get an endorsement. SCLC was meeting 2 weeks later in Birmingham for their annual meeting, and that was the one organization in the black community, of major national organization, we were able to get that endorsement. But then after Thomas got on the Supreme Court and made a number of his decisions that really were inconsistent with that, Reverend Lowery was disappointed. I was embarrassed. And so, indeed, that is one decision that I really wish I had not been involved in.
So he turned out to be kind of anti a lot of what, anti-affirmative action.
Yes.
And these are things that he had benefited from.
Exactly. And that was ironic that he seemed to be so negative about that. You know, another person who benefited from affirmative action was Justice Sotomayor.
Yes.
She acknowledges this. She went to Princeton, did well, then went on to Yale Law School and did well, and states that she might not have gotten admitted without those affirmative actions being taken. But we knew, many of us knew, that the reasons that many of us did not have these opportunities were not because of academic capability or merit, but were bias. So affirmative action is really designed to help counter years and years of bias and unequal opportunity.
Yes, yes.
Suffered by blacks and other minorities over the years. So I'm all for affirmative action. We still have vestiges of discrimination left from that. So we have to be vigilant. We have not reached that ideal society yet that all of us strive for.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about your personal life. When you joined the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, you literally hit the ground running. And by that I mean that you took your people out to run in the morning. And you still do that with Ginger. Talk about how this walking with Ginger ended up in the Department of Health and Human Services.
Well, that's an interesting story because back in the early 70s, Ginger and I decided that we needed to become more active physically because we thought we were perhaps starting to put on a little weight. So this was really for weight control that we started. But when we started walking, we found we enjoyed that. This was really getting out in the fresh air. We felt invigorated by that. We also found that we were talking about family issues, things with the children or with the mortgage or other decisions, what are we going to do for vacation, et cetera. So this became a habit that we enjoyed. So when I went to Washington, I decided that I would invite the employees in the department to walk with me because I knew that they didn't know who I was. And I also was new to government, and I needed to know as much about the department as I could. So I invited the employees to join me for my morning walks, and particularly when I went to our 10 regional offices around the country in Dallas or Denver or Seattle, elsewhere. So I would have anywhere between 25 to 175 people who would join me for a walk. That way I began to know the people in the department, would hear about issues there. They appreciated getting to meet a secretary. Many of them had been in the department for years and had never met or seen a secretary in person. So that formed a very good bond and was very helpful to me in my working relationship with members of the department. We became a team working together to solve problems.
Working and walking together.
Absolutely, right.
Well, now, you played the trumpet at Morehouse, and you were a member of the Glee Club, as was Maynard, my husband. Did y'all sing together by any chance?
Oh, yes.
Oh, really?
Yes, Maynard was 2 years behind me at Morehouse. He was in the Glee Club. We enjoyed our relationship together. And interestingly, when I came back from Boston to start Morehouse School of Medicine, he was now mayor.
Ah.
And so he invited
me. So you had that hookup, too, now.
Yes.
Those Morehouse men.
Oh, yes. So he and one of the first things he did was invite me to lunch down at the Commerce Club in the mayor's room there.
Where we used to not be able to eat.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So, and Maynard knew exactly what he was doing, welcoming me back to Atlanta and to Morehouse, but also making a statement by meeting with me at the Commerce Club.
Interesting. You and Ginger have 3 children, 2 sons and a daughter. One son is a radiologist in Dallas, Texas. You have a daughter who's an art historian and actor, and Halstead, your son, a Harvard Law grad and comedy writer. That's a big gap, a big spread
there. Yes, that shows you that you never know what will appeal to your children, but they have, my oldest son obviously has gone into medicine and he's enjoying that, being a radiologist. But Shanta, as an actress, has been in summer stock on Martha's Vineyard, also in New York, and now is in Los Angeles.
Great.
And then Halstead, our youngest, has been one of the writers and co-producers for the television show The Office that had a long run. Wow. That's now off, but he's now developing a new series himself. He's living in Los Angeles as a writer. So Ginger and I are enjoying seeing the careers that our children chosen and how they're doing.
And by the way, your first son's name is Paul. I don't want to, we mentioned the other two names. I want Paul to get his due also. Mm-hmm. So quickly, what do you think about the medical marijuana issue in Georgia?
Well, my position on that is this. I think that for medical uses, marijuana certainly has been shown to be helpful. And I think it can be made available as a regulated drug so that the value of this can be available. I'm not for the recreational use of marijuana for several reasons. Could be a gateway drug. That is, too many instances of young people starting with marijuana but ending up on heroin or other dangerous products. Secondly, we don't want to have a lot of people on our highways who may be in various stages of intoxication here. So we don't know enough about this drug to really be making it available for recreational use as is occurring in some of our states. I'm very concerned about that, as a citizen, as a physician. So certainly for medical uses, I'm all for it. But recreational use, I'm not.
You also founded an organization called the Medical Education for South African Blacks. What was the purpose of that?
Yes. Well, this was an organization that came into being in 1985 with the purpose of facilitating the entry of black students in the health professions in South Africa. This organization actually was founded by Herb and Joy Kaiser. Herb had been a U.S. Foreign Service officer and had retired in 1983. One of his postings had been in South Africa. While in South Africa, he had been diagnosed with melanoma. Oh. And he had surgery, and he was cured. But he was acutely aware of the situation of blacks in South Africa, and he knew that had he been black, that he probably would have been dead, because he would not have gotten the care that he did get as a white person. So Herb asked if I would work with him to form this organization back in 1983, which I did, and went to South Africa for the first time in 1985, because apartheid was being dismantled and blacks were being admitted to the universities in South Africa for the first time. But most of the time, there were no scholarships available for them. So for most black students, this was a meaningless gesture. Attending medical school in South Africa at that time cost an average around $5,000. Not a lot of money by U.S. standards at that time, but at that time, the average annual income for a black family in South Africa was $500.
Ooh.
So the idea of being able to go to medical school was really out of the question. So we felt that this was something that we could address. So we formed this organization with representatives both from the U.S. and from South Africa, and we gave scholarships to the students. So the organization existed from 1985 to 2008, and we supported more than 10,000 students in South Africa during that time, medical school, dental school, mm-hmm. nursing school, mm-hmm. and other health professions. They all were supported in South Africa rather than bringing them here, because we wanted them to have their education in the South African culture, where they would really be closer to what is the South African medical establishment.
And that feeds into your philosophy where we all have to, where every diverse element or section of the society, because each of us is a cell in the body politic
exactly.
and in the health arena.
Yes.
And so I glean from your work that you believe that working across these borders and between races and countries and whatnot is really what's going to strengthen the health system throughout the world, which is what we all need.
Absolutely.
But before I close, though, I want to ask you quickly to just speak to the National Health Museum that's here in Atlanta.
The purpose of our National Health Museum is to improve the health literacy of Americans, because I believe that one of the major things we have to do to really improve the health of our citizens and to control costs is to improve our lifestyle. So many diseases that we have now are influenced, if not caused, by our lifestyle. One of the biggest examples, cigarette smoking. Number one preventable cause of death in the country. But other problems, our diets are not right. We have a rising incidence of obesity. We also have a significant prevalence of high blood pressure that leads to heart attacks, strokes, et cetera. These things can be influenced by lifestyle, by weight. Exercise is beneficial for that. It lowers the likelihood of developing a heart attack or stroke. Lowers blood pressure if you have high blood pressure. There's even some early evidence that regular exercise could delay the onset of Alzheimer's disease. So we need to improve our lifestyle because over the years we've become too sedentary. We're sitting in front of television screens or computer screens rather than out playing basketball or running around track, et cetera. So the Health Museum is designed to indeed empower Americans to take charge of their health, and that will not only improve health, but will lower health care costs by avoiding a number of the costs that we are paying today.
Thank you so much, Dr. Sullivan, for joining us today. I'm going to go home and take a walk.
Very good.
That's it for today. I'm Valerie Jackson, in conversation with Dr. Lewis W. Sullivan. Thanks for joining us this evening. You can listen to this and other episodes of In Conversation by visiting our audio archive online at wabe.org/inconversation. Until next time, this is Valerie Jackson in Conversation. This series is a production of WABE FM 90.1 and Public Broadcasting Atlanta. The producer for the program is Marjorie Greenbaum. The technical producer and editor is Mike Johns. Programming support by Lois Reitzes and Dave Baraswain. And I'm your host, Valerie Jackson. Thanks for listening. Good night.